But for this evening, in terms of thinking about the topics we wanted to address in this spring lecture series, particularly from feminist voices is sort of what we were particularly looking at. And I had read Andrea's book this summer and was very impressed. In fact, I had a conversation with Winona LaDuke, who was here last week, about that, and said it's sort of like reading Ward Churchill, only with not that sort of kind of harsh sort of slant to it. But again, I think if you haven't read it, and the books are here for sale in the lobby, if you'd like to get one before you go, I'd encourage you to do so. It's a well-written, well-researched text. But I'm not going to introduce Andrea. I'm going to have Debbie Muller introduce her. As I said, she sort of helped orchestrate some of the stuff today. And she's both with the Potawatomi and Odawa communities here in the West Michigan area. She's also a member of the Native American Community Services. She's a chairperson for the Coalition of Indian Programs and Services of Grand Rapids and Kent County. She also serves on the as a commissioner on the Grand Rapids Community Relations Commission Board with a few other folks who are in the room, and a whole bunch of other things. But I'll stop right there, and please join me in welcoming Debbie Muller.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your kind words. Bonjour, Shkodan Skwe Nadijnakaz, Natawasepi here on Potawatomi, Mashika, Ndodam, and Awashtenongadawa. I've been taught by my elders to introduce myself that way in our sacred language. Unfortunately, I'm not fluent, so I can't tell you much more other than my name. I'm also known as my foreign name, which is Deborah Muller. And it is my privilege and my honor to have been given the opportunity to introduce Andrea Smith. I asked her if there was anything in particular that she would like me to say, and she basically said, no, just say, here's Andy. I said, oh, wait a minute here. There's more to the story than just that, which in fact there is. She has traveled from coast to coast and communities to communities in various initiatives and various movements for the sake of helping people address various perspectives on violence and sexual violence as well. She is Oklahoma Cherokee, and while she was in Chicago, she also became very involved in the American Indian Movement, and at that time also a group was initiated that was called the Women of All Red Nations. She served on that. She then went to New York, and there she pursued her master's, that she was going to be an MSW, get her master's in social working, changed her mind. And in the meeting this afternoon, it was really delightful because she says, my education is kind of like just an accident. And I thought that was really a very appropriate way of putting that, because she seems really that she just kind of stumbled upon all of these wonderful intellectual gifts, but they are gifts from Gitche Manitou that she certainly has known about throughout her whole life, yet she has the humbleness and as well as the simplicity to say that my education is just kind of an accident. She has her doctorate in the history of consciousness, and right now she's an associate professor at University of Michigan, Native American Studies, and also Women's Studies. I also asked her about the awards and recognitions that she had been given, and she says, well, we're not going to talk about those. And of course I said, oh, come on. No, we're not. So I guess we're not. But I'm sure that she has many that have followed her from all of the areas that she has been in, from the coast of California, through, and finally she's landed in Michigan for a spell, and so we are really very fortunate to have her here. So in honor of Andrea's being with us. We also have Benjamin Williams and Tim Loonsfoot from the Native American community. And we would like to ask you to stand, if you could, remove your hats, unless you have, of course, our sacred feather in it, in honor of Andrea's visit. Thank you.
Hello. I just wanted to thank you. I'm really kind of overwhelmed by the introduction and the song. I feel really feel very humbled, especially hearing about all the great work being done here by the Native peoples in this community. So I really want to thank you and also just acknowledge the Indigenous peoples of this land that provide the opportunity for us to even be here at all. And also, I just should be clarify that even though my name is on a book, it's the case that ideas don't come from one person alone, and so I see the book more not so much about my particular brilliant analysis, but more me having the opportunity to hear from other people and being part of collective struggles and collective movements and being able to learn from other people. So it's more of a recording of the ideas that I've been able to come across that I thought might be good to share with other people as well who are thinking about the same issues. In any case, kind of how I came to kind of working on this, I could think of three kind of pivotal incidents. One time when I was living in Oklahoma, I got an opportunity to go to this this kind of gathering of for one of the Native ministry programs. And one person came to visit, and he was a spiritual leader, and he said the most important thing that we have to worry about is violence against women and children. He said, because as long as we are destroying ourselves from within, we don't even have to worry about the enemies from outside. So that was pivotal to me. But then the next thing that happened was I went back home and I was telling a friend who was herself a sexual assault survivor, and I told her about what he said, and she said, do you mean other Indians have been raped too? And I said, well, yes. And she said, why aren't we ever talking about it? So then I was kind of struck by the silence that's in our communities about the issue. But then the next thing that was kind of pivotal to me is I went, when I was working in Chicago, a young woman was gang raped by prominent members of the community, and kind of the response of the community when she threatened to go to the police was to kind of basically put her on trial and say, how dare you air our dirty laundry to other people. And on the other hand, when she went to get services, there was nothing that was really helpful for her either, because the response of the mainstream movement was, well, why don't you just leave your community? So in all these cases, what I was seeing was a major issue of sexual violence, and yet there was no vocabulary for how to understand what was happening to Native women. And what I began to conclude was that there was a problem with our analysis, that we were seeing violence against women as a separate thing from colonization. We need to worry about colonization first, and then later we will worry about violence against women. Or conversely, in the white feminist movement, we'll just worry about violence and all these other issues will take care of themselves. And we were not seeing that these two processes were actually part of the same thing, and that is precisely through sexual violence that American Indian genocide is successful, and that we can't decolonize without making addressing sexual violence central to our organizing work. So the way that I kind of see sexual violence as part of the logic of genocide is that I borrow from Ann Stoller, who says that racism is a process by which certain peoples become marked as inherently dirty, as inherently pure, from which the larger colonial body is always trying to clean itself. And if we look at the history of Native genocide, we see again and again this rhetoric of Native bodies being equated with pollution or dirt. So just to give one example, this was an Ivory soap ad from 1885, and there's kind of a cartoonish figure of an Indian man and woman, and this is the slogan that goes with the cartoon. We were once factious, fierce, and wild, in peaceful arts unreconciled, our blankets smeared with grease and stains from buffalo meat and settlers' veins, through summer's dust and heat content, from moon to moon unwashed we went. But ivory soap came like a ray of light across our darkened way, and now we're civil, kind, and good, and keep the laws as people should. We wear our linen, lawn, and lace, as well as folks with paler face. And now I take, wherever we go, this cake of ivory soap to show what civilized my squaw and me and made us clean and fair to see. So we can see the joke of this ad is that because Indian bodies can't be white, they can never be clean. And under a patriarchal worldview, only a body that is seen as pure can be violated. The violation or rape of bodies that are seen as impure don't count. They are seen as inherently rapable. So to give an example, when sex workers are raped, nobody cares because they are seen as inherently rapable, inherently violable. And that is what has happened through the logic of genocide. Native peoples have become seen as inherently rapable, inherently violable, and by extension, our lands are inherently invadable. So when we look at the history of massacres, it's not just that Indian people were killed off, but this is always accompanied by routine mutilation, sexual violence, etc. And I'll just give one example to illustrate this from the Sand Creek Massacre. I heard one man say he had cut a woman's private parts out and had them for exhibition on a stick. I heard another man say he had cut the fingers off of an Indian to get the rings off of his hand. I also heard of numerous instances in which men had cut out the private parts of females, stretched them over their saddle bows, and some of them over their hats. So what's happening then in this process is that colonizers are not just trying to kill Indian people, but to kill our sense of even being a people. In addition to this, one of the major complaints that colonizers made when they first came to these lands is they said, how are we going to ever colonize them when they themselves are not structured on hierarchy? That is, they're not patriarchal. They don't necessarily have these hierarchical societies in which the leaders get to lead forever in perpetuity. So if they're not accepting that kind of leadership within their communities, why are they going to accept it from us? So they said that we will never be able to colonize them, and they said this explicitly, until Native men start treating Native women the way white men treat white women. And so, therefore, if you want to colonize a people, it's not going to work until colonization seems natural. Because if you know there's another way to live, you're going to do that. You're not going to accept domination from other people. So the way to make domination seem natural is to instill it through patriarchy. That is, just as men are naturally supposed to rule over women by virtue of biology, so it is the case that socially some people are naturally born to rule over other peoples. So sexual violence was a process by which hierarchy becomes literally inscribed on the bodies of Native peoples. So when we're looking at this logic of sexual violence, it's broader than just simply looking at rape or sexual assault. It kind of infuses a variety of practices that Native peoples have to address. So I'll just kind of briefly go through a few of them to illustrate what I mean. One policy where you can see this logic of sexual violence is that of environmental racism. That is, certain communities who are seen as inherently impure or dirty then become seen as the worthy repositories of all nuclear waste or toxic waste. Since they're inherently polluting anyway, more pollution on their land doesn't count. And that's why the United Church of Christ found that the greatest determinant of where toxic waste are sited is race, even more than class. And Native peoples have been particularly targeted with nuclear and toxic waste dumping. And the reason for this is because, in the end, environmental pollution doesn't actually discriminate against on the basis of race. It will impact everybody. But corporations, by targeting a few communities that nobody cares about, it allows everybody else to be in denial about this fact that it's eventually going to hurt them too. So just to give an example, in Oklahoma, I don't know if you saw the movie Silkwood, the one with Meryl Streep. Well, anyway, that company was Sequoia Fuels from Kerr McGee. It was running a nuclear conversion facility. Anyway, after she died under mysterious circumstances, Native Americans for Clean Environment took up her work to get them shut down. And this is actually another story, a very great victory that they, a very small group, were successful in kicking Kerr McGee not only out of Oklahoma, but the entire United States. But that's another story. In any case, during the struggle, what they found out was that you have to pay when you want to dispose of nuclear waste. And so it was in the financial interest of Kerr McGee to kind of make this waste disappear. So what they were doing is, one, when they were putting the waste in the trucks, they just weren't turning the containers on tight enough. And so this waste was leaking down the freeways. And there was nothing on these trucks that says, hey, I have nuclear waste here. So again, this was going to be affecting everybody, not just Native people who live along these roads. The next thing they decided to do was turn this nuclear waste into fertilizer. And they would feed these cows, and they would undercut the sale of normal fertilizer because they were just trying to get rid of it. And there was nothing that on these cows, like if you were to buy milk from these cows, beef from these cows, there was nothing that would be marked that said, hey, this cow was fed on nuclear waste. So again, this is an example of a thing that seems to be just affecting Native peoples would eventually affect everybody as well. But as Getchy Cook further notes, we can also see environmental racism as another form of sexual violence, because the effects of environmental contamination tend to first become manifest often in women's reproductive systems. So for instance, we see areas like in Akwesasne where women have PCBs in their breast milk. in the areas in Four Corners, we see major birth defect rates, et cetera, where there's been nuclear contamination, and where the most intense effects of this can be found in the indigenous women of Marshall Islands, where the U.S. basically used them as guinea pigs. They exploded these nuclear bombs that were much more powerful than the bombs thrown in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and didn't evacuate the peoples there. And the result, the devastating effects on women's reproductive systems is almost kind of mind-boggling. Here's a testimony. The most common birth defects has been jellyfish babies. These babies are born with no bones in their bodies and with transparent skin. We can see their brains and hearts beating. The babies usually live for a day or two before they stop breathing. Many women die from abnormal pregnancies, and those who survive give birth to what look like purple grapes that we quickly bury. So Hanani Trask reports that the life expectancy has gone down to 40 years in the area, and that some communities have decided to go extinct because their DNA has been permanently altered, and they can't give birth now to children that don't have major birth defects. And actually, I was just recently at this International Women in Health meeting in India, and representatives came from the Marshall Islands. And I was very much struck with what they said, because what they report, they talked about how they had like 8 or 9 miscarriages. Nobody had ever been able to give birth to a baby that didn't have major birth defects. And they said that the reason they were there was not to organize for on their own behalf. They said, it's too late for us. There's nothing that we can do for ourselves. We're here to stop this from happening to you. We're the testimony to what happens with nuclear contamination. So they weren't even trying to organize for their own survival. They were trying to organize for the world's survival. So again, we can see how another form of sexual violence has been perpetrated by against indigenous women through these policies of environmental racism. Another policy we can see that kind of follows a similar logic is that issues of sterilization abuse. As Inez Hernandez notes, if you want to kill off a population, you have to target the women. Otherwise, a population may not be severely affected. And that's something that colonizers explicitly stated. They said after massacres, make sure you finish off the women so that we can finish off that population. So it's not a surprise then that Native women's ability to reproduce then becomes imaged as inherently polluting, particularly in the population control movement we see. Many environmental groups are saying the reason why there's so much pollution is there's too many of them polluting our environment. They're destroying it for the rest of us. And so particularly during the 1970s when the population control movement began to proliferate, we saw all these slogans of we need to stop Native women from reproducing so that they don't pollute the world for everybody else. So you may be familiar with this, so I won't go as on to it, but it basically this the sterilization abuse became uncovered when one Cherokee Choctaw doctor had a woman come in for a womb transplant. She had been given a hysterectomy and had been told that it was reversible. And when she went to investigate, she found that this was not an isolated incident. And actually, the U.S. did its own investigation and found that there was mass numbers of women being sterilized without being sterilized, and they were not following the proper procedures. But interestingly, they would not find out if they had been given consent, because they said women won't remember if they consented to a sterilization. Now, you have to ask, if you don't remember consenting to a sterilization, something went wrong. But in any case, that was the logic used by the U.S. government. So they were even covering up the issue of informed consent. But in any case, and interestingly, though, when you look at the kind of the rhetoric that was being used to by doctors for sterilizing women, and this is what Dr. Kaniyuri found out, again, we see the same logic of pollution coming up. For instance, one woman was sterilized because, quote, she was told she was, quote, dirty and unkempt, and hence she should be sterilized. Another woman went to a doctor for stomach problems, and the doctor said, well, why the hell don't you get your tubes tied so you won't get sick anymore? And another woman told a doctor told another woman that her head hurt because she was afraid to be, oh, I'm sorry, start over again. One woman went into a doctor because she had headaches, and the doctor said that she had headaches because she was afraid of becoming pregnant and advised her to get sterilized. So she did, but the headaches persisted, and she later found out she had a brain tumor. And this happened to a friend of mine. She went in for Indian Health for a back surgery, and they didn't touch her back, but she came out without a uterus. So in any case, after this issue became publicly known, there was Indian Health Services did put stricter measures to monitor sterilization, but it comes up again in things like promoting Depo-Provera, which I probably don't have time to give the whole lowdown on why. Just because a drug is approved by the FDA does not necessarily mean it's safe, and that it's important to do your own research to make sure that this is the contraceptive of choice. But it's very disturbing when we look at the major studies that were done to prove Depo-Provera's safety. It's a long-acting hormonal contraceptive that you get a shot in your arm and it's supposed to last for 3 months. Anyway, the biggest study in Grady Clinic in Atlanta, what happened was that any woman who had major side effects was simply eliminated from the data. So the Black Women Health Project went to double check, and they found that half of the women had been eliminated from the survey results. And they found from these women, there was women having mastectomies at the age of 20, suicidal depression, cancer, et cetera, major side effects that were just conveniently lost when the clinic had to report the safety data. Anyway, originally, when it first came up for approval by the FDA, it was not approved. But even though it had not been approved, it was still being used in Indian Health Services for women with disability. And what was the reason given? Again, hygienics. We need to keep women cleaner, Native women cleaner. Let's see. To quote Burton Attico from the Phoenix Indian Health Services said, quote, "We use it to stop their periods. There's nothing else that will do it. To have to change a pad on someone developmentally disabled, you've got major problems. The fact that they become infertile is a side benefit." And then Raymond Janet from Phoenix IHS said, quote, "Depo-Provera turned them back into their sweet, poor, handicapped selves. I take some pride in being a pioneer in that regard." And all of them admitted that they were not getting consent from either the women getting Depo-Provera or their parents. So in any of these cases, I'll just briefly take a little aside to show that this also shows the need to kind of look at issues of reproductive justice outside of a choice framework. That is, the way we look at these issues, it's often pro-life versus pro-choice. And the assumption behind this pro-choice, there's a number of problematic assumptions, but one big one is that the only important choice is the choice of whether or not you're going to have an abortion, and all the other economic and political and social conditions that gave rise to you having to make this choice suddenly kind of disappear from the analysis. So, for instance, when Bill Clinton signs into law anti-welfare or anti-immigration legislation that certainly doesn't do anything to promote choice for poor women or immigrant women, nobody was organizing as an anti-choice president, you know, because we were looking at it in a very narrow way. And certainly for Native peoples, if we're going to, you know, fight for reproductive justice, we have to develop a holistic framework that looks at all the conditions that give rise to the so-called choices that we make. And then finally, I'll just mention another brief example of kind of this policy of sexual violence in which Native peoples become seen as kind of inherently inhuman, as property, as something for somebody else's benefit, is the issue of medical experimentation. And I kind of mention this in case there's any scientists in the audience, because what we found is that many activists are looking at this and finding these widespread medical experimentation programs going on in Native communities, but we don't necessarily have the medical expertise to do anything about it, to advocate for it. And then meanwhile, people that do have that expertise, they tend to unquestionably assume that if doctors are doing something, it must be good. So if there's anybody who's got the expertise and wants to do more investigation, this would be very beneficial. In fact, I remember in Chicago when we were looking at the one of these programs, somebody from the local paper started doing this investigative report, and she was coming with all this material, and then suddenly she got word the Indian Health Services intervened, and then she was immediately silenced, and she was never able to publish kind of the work that came out of that. One program that just to illustrate was one that happened amongst Alaska Native children in 1992, where they were given a hepatitis B vaccine. And two activists, Mary Ann Mills and Bernadine Atchison, went to investigate because they had not been given permission to be part of this trial vaccine. And in any case, they started to worry that virus might have been tainted with other things, such as the HIV virus. But we don't know. We haven't been able to find out conclusively whether or not it was. But in the process of these investigations, it was very interesting to look at the rhetoric being used by U.S. agencies to support this trial vaccine program. For instance, the Arctic Research Policy Committee said that, quote, "Native villages were an extensive database and an ideal laboratory which provides a resource for studying health problems that will benefit other populations. And the company that did the vaccine, Merck Sharp and Dohme, said that they experimented on, quote, chimpanzees and Alaska Native children. So again, we see Native people seen as laboratory animals, not as people deserving respect or integrity. And I'll just mention, during this research that they were engaged in, they got a letter from Teresa Brown from Clear Lake, California, to testify about her experiment, history of medical experimentation. She says, quote, in 1929, we were removed from the Catholic Church into the Indian Bureau. When we got into the Indian Bureau, we were used as guinea pigs. They gave us vaccinations. Needles broke in some of people's arms. They were not removed. Then they came into the reservation for dental work. They drilled from under our jaws and into our mouths and caused infections. They put black stuff into our teeth as experiments. This was very painful. We were used by the government to test a new material as fillings for teeth. Today, the dentists look at our mouth and tell us there was never anything wrong with our teeth in the first place. They used us to make drugs for other people. They gave so many of us vaccinations, and after the vaccinations, many people became sick with tuberculosis. Most of our people died from tuberculosis and smallpox that were given to us by the government. This was forced on us, and we had no choice. And I will answer to anyone that this is what happened to us in Big Valley in California. Okay, so now after hearing all the depressing news, the issue is, what is to be done? So this kind of then gives rise to kind of the history of how we started to think about how to work on these issues differently. I had been involved in the anti-violence movement, and we were kind of getting annoyed with kind of the approach to multiculturalism that was being adopted in these movements, which was basically take the model that has been developed with white women in mind and then put a medicine wheel on it, and it becomes an Indian model. And we started to say, is there a different way to do this work? Because it seemed like all the monies we'd put into this was not really ending violence. We're not seeing a decline in the rates of violence against women. And in particular, what we started to say is that we need to develop a different approach that's beyond kind of a politics of inclusion, which is just include you in this, and then we will be all diverse and feel happy with ourselves, and instead developing an approach which we call recentering, which is, what if we centered women of color in the analysis? How would we look at this issue differently? And when we did that, we saw that women of color, and Native women in particular, are not just dealing with violence in our communities, we are also equally dealing with state violence. And as I've just demonstrated, the state is primarily responsible for the sexual violence in our communities. So it doesn't really make sense to think the state's going to be the solution to the problems that it has created. And we are seeing that today when we look at the effect of all the laws that we tried to get passed. For instance, we passed these mandatory arrest laws where you have to arrest somebody on a domestic violence charge, and now they're arresting the women who are being battered. Beth Ritchie, who's a sociologist in Chicago, found that a quarter to the half of the women in Chicago jails were there on domestic violence charges. And we see women who are undocumented, they report the police, and they find themselves being deported. I remember one woman that I had to work with, she was an African-American woman who had been gang raped. When she called the police arrested her for prostitution. So the New York Times, in fact, found a report that said that the effect of all these laws we tried to get passed has led to a situation in which battered women are killing their partners less often, but batterers are not killing their partners less often. And I should just briefly mention, why is this not going to really work? The basic problem with the prison system approach is that the prison is based on the idea that you have a few wacko guys you have to lock up. But when we have surveys in which half the men say they would rape somebody if they thought they could get away with it, you would either have to arrest half the male population, or you see that that's not going to be the solution to what we really need, which is an approach designed to transform a culture that supports violence against women. And indeed, if we look at the history of prisons, prisons has never, ever been shown to lead to reduction in crime rates for a number of reasons. And I would argue that that's not the reason for prisons. They're not there primarily to stop crime. They're there primarily to incarcerate communities of color. But that's another story if you would like to talk more about the prison industrial complex. In any case, it becomes clear that if we want to address what's going on in Native communities, we need an approach that addresses state violence at the same time that we're addressing violence within our communities. So then the question is, well, what is to be done? Well, therefore, we started to look at other models, and this is how Incite Women of Color Against Violence formed. And we looked to other models in terms of the restorative justice framework. If you're not familiar with that, that's a movement that's part of the anti-prison movement that says, well, crime is not just between a victim and a perpetrator. Crime is about a breakdown in the whole community, so you need a community-based response. And if somebody is not following the norms of society, does it make sense to take them even more out of society, put them in prison where they're going to be even less likely to fit into that community when they come back? Or does it make sense to have the community develop a response that makes that person behave in an appropriate way? So this looks all very well and good, but the problem is that these models all seem to break down when it comes to domestic and sexual violence. And the reason is that they're all based on the notion that we have a community that's intact, that's not sexist, homophobic, or otherwise problematic, and that they will actually side with the person who's been victimized by violence. But as we all know, when it comes to issues of sexual and domestic violence, communities often don't side with the woman or the person who's been victimized by violence. They often side with the perpetrator, so they're not going to hold them accountable. So therefore, it became clear that we needed an approach that would be community-based, however, would not depend on a romanticized notion of community, or even depend on the notion that the community even exists, but it would have to be a political organizing project that was about creating communities that would hold people accountable. So with that, we came up with a number of recommendations or things that we learned in this process, and we're still learning as we go along. One thing we started to do was try to develop strategies that directly address interpersonal and state violence at the same time. And there's been many of these, but I'll just briefly mention one, which is a boarding school healing project. If you're not familiar with the history of boarding schools, this was the policy of the U.S. government, which was to save the man by killing the Indian. So basically the idea was to abduct Native children from an early age, take them from their homes, force them to be Christians, force them to speak English, and there was just rampant sexual, physical, and emotional violence. And this is really where we see the large-scale introduction of violence in our communities, where Native children were not parented, so then they couldn't pass that on to their own children. And in fact, I've been in many workshops where we're supposed to trace kind of where does dysfunctionality start in your family, and almost invariably it's the community that first goes to a boarding school. In any case, and you might have been heard in Canada where there's been all these lawsuits against residential schools, which was similar to the boarding schools here, and all the rampant sexual violence. There turned out to be pedophile rings involving priests and police officers and priests and clergy members. There was unmarked graves in some schools where children had been buried because they had been born to girls had been raped by the priests. And some people are calculating as many as 50,000 children were killed in this during this period. But there hasn't been the same similar outcry in the U.S., and many of the documentation programs tend to present a more sanitized view of boarding schools. So we started a documentation program to document these abuses. But the idea about this was to not so much pursue individual lawsuits, but to build a movement for collective remedy against Native peoples to address the continuing effects of human rights violations perpetrated by state policy. So this then enabled us to make kind of two interventions. One, we're able to say, well, why do we think, again, the state's going to be the solution to ending sexual violence in our communities when the state is responsible for bringing it into our communities? And at the same time, it enabled us to talk a little more freely about issues of sexual violence within our communities because we could show, look, this isn't about we're so dysfunctional and that's why we have sexual violence. This is the colonial legacy. This is the effect of state policy of which we should hold the state accountable. And as we pursue our struggle for sovereignty, then let's make sexual violence part of that struggle because that's how colonization has been successful. So again, we've been documenting this, and we're starting to find that the abuses that were as extreme in Canada are happening here, too. Just to give one example, one woman reported how in her school, they used to hear babies crying all the time, and they didn't know what it was, but then later they tore down the school, and they found the skeletons of babies hidden in the walls of that school. So anyway, that's one approach, as of many, where you kind of can put the state policy together with interpersonal violence and address them simultaneously. Another thing that we found is that one of the problems with the anti-violence movement, particularly as it got more federal and state funding, is that we stopped seeing survivors of violence as potential organizers and started seeing them only as clients for services. And consequently, that did not enable us to build a stronger and stronger base of survivors who could demand an end to violence in their lives and the lives of other peoples. So that's why some of these projects are now trying to focus on base building, which is not just working with other activists or not just working with other advocates, but bringing new women and new other peoples who aren't already activists into the movement. And so some of these base building responses, one, for instance, is Sister to Sister in Brooklyn, New York, which works with young women of color ages 13 to 18. So they're doing this on their own. And they started kind of doing dance classes, and then they developed to actually starting daycare centers that brought all these women in the community. But then through this process of political education, these women who went for dance classes or girls who went for dance classes ended up becoming trained organizers. So they ended up doing an interesting video monitoring police violence in their own communities, and they got the Burger King across the street from the police station and showed their video on the actual police station walls. This got them into a little bit of trouble, but they did get a lot of education work within their community. And then they've started their own community accountability model, where instead of calling 911, you can call them. And they've developed an entire accountability process. However, we've learned that in developing these models, it's important to not just look within the U.S., but look what is going on globally. Because sometimes we have the idea, well, we in the U.S. know everything, so we should share the light to the rest of the planet. But actually, on the issues of violence, what we've found is that in other countries, there's just no illusion the state's going to do anything for you at all except kill you. So groups have had to find ways to deal with violence on their own, and they've come up with some very interesting models. So I will just mention one of the many that we've learned from, and that's the landless movement in Brazil, which is very much informed by indigenous people's organizing strategies. Anyway, the landless movement takes over an area that's been abandoned and occupies it until they get the win the right to title over this land. And they call this occupation. So during this time, they're not going to get any help from the police because the police are trying to drive them off the land. But what they do is they've set up their own governance system. And they say what they do is, one, they have different sectors, but they make sure a man and a woman are equally represented in all areas of leadership. And they also say they make sure women are equally in charge of security because that makes women rethink and other people rethink women's vulnerability to violence. And in addition, they also make sure leadership is rotating so that there's no static hierarchical leadership. And then finally, they also make sure that all decisions are dealt with in a very public and transparent way, because abuse tends to proliferate when there is isolation and nobody else knows what's going on. So they make sure everything's public so that it's harder to get away with this. Anyway, what they say is that there's no panacea, but the longer an occupation happens, the less violence there is. So this, I think, is helpful for us in the U.S. because we tend to focus on crisis intervention. What do you do after violence has happened? But what they are doing is creating communities where violence stops happening. So that's what we could think to ourselves. Is there new ways of governing ourselves? Is there new ways of structuring our world such that violence starts to become unthinkable? And that's, I think, we can also then be informed by indigenous peoples organizing and indigenous, particularly indigenous women's theories about nationhood and sovereignty, because what is coming out of this work is saying that there's a difference between a nation and a nation state. So you can have national sovereignty and self-determination, but the model of governance that you might have may not be the nation state that we're used to, where somebody's in charge and they rule by power and might and they have a military, etc. And they argue that if we look to pre-colonial forms of governance, we can see alternative models in which we were governed based on cooperation and mutual respect and responsibility. And the goal was not so much we're in, you're out, screw the rest of the world, but it was about being in a rightful and good relationship to everybody, everybody on a global scale as well as within your own particular community. And this similar philosophy is happening amongst indigenous peoples in Latin America, where, again, they are questioning the old forms of organizing where it was hierarchical leadership, and instead saying, no, we can have models based on radical participatory democracy where we all get to be involved in the decision-making, and where there isn't static leadership. But they say to us, they say, what you need to learn from our experience is that it's not just enough to have your own kind of autonomous area, because as long as you do that, you're going to have a problem with U.S. empire and multinational capitalism that's always going to try to squash you. So what we've had to do is not only establish our autonomous areas, but we have to proliferate them. So once we got a system going, a few people have to go to another place and develop another area. And they keep growing and growing until they're able to take over entire countries. And we see what's going on in Bolivia, Venezuela, Argentina, etc. This is all the result of that kind of organizing. And it shows you that you can be democratic and still be efficient. You can still be powerful. And so I think this gives us hope to rethink how we might be able to do organizing here. However, to do so, and I'll just briefly mention, we have to rethink the nonprofit industrial complex, which is where all of our social movements is done through the nonprofit system, which most of our money tends to come from foundations. And what has happened is, as our movements have become folded into the nonprofit system, is that we have lost our incentive to build movements. Because if we were funded by our constituents, we would have a big financial incentive to make sure we had as many constituents as possible. However, if we're funded by a foundation, we don't have that same incentive. So we end up with executive directors working 5,000 hours a week, trying to make up for the work that millions of people need to be involved in. And if we look at our current political situation, we basically have an economic situation in which 5% of the population controls 95% of the wealth. So the bad news is that they have all the guns and money. But the good news is there's a lot more of us than them. However, we're going to need to get these numbers behind us if we really want to change that pyramid system. So that means we need to develop mass movements for change. And that needs to be kind of the focus of our work. And actually, I was talking to, again, folks from Latin America, and they said, we laugh at your protests. They said, you have a movement, you know, you have a protest, you have 200 people walking around a circle, and then you get a police permit to protest police brutality. So that was their understanding of our movement organizing. And they said, you know, in Chile, they said after Allende's assassination, we were able to get out 1 million people every week, and that would be the equivalent of 40 million people in the U.S. out every week. So that's the kind of scale they're charging us to start to look to. How can we build kind of a mass movement for change? But to do this, of course, not all these millions of people are not going to all be able to get paid to do the work. So we're going to need to think of a different model of organizing in which you don't become a career activist necessarily, but you organize, you do your organizing as part of your day-to-day life. So you may not be able to give up 30 hours a week for organizing, but if you did, maybe you could do a half hour a week. But if 40 million people did a half hour a week, that could really change the system we have here in the country. So and then also this kind of makes us rethink then our relationship to the nonprofit system again. What they're saying is that nonprofits aren't necessarily bad, however, they differentiate movements from nonprofits. They say you don't do a movement through a nonprofit, you do a movement through your people, and you fund it through your people. Then you get a nonprofit to support the movement, and the nonprofit answers to the movement. And but if the nonprofit gets defunded, you're okay because you still have your movement. But that doesn't mean you can't set up a nonprofit and get support and get resources whenever you have the possibility to do so. So what if we thought about the anti-violence movement in that way? Instead of thinking of the current kind of agencies as the anti-violence movement, what if we developed an independent anti-violence movement that was funded by its own constituents, but then was supported by nonprofit domestic violence and sexual assault agencies, where we had a relationship of accountability between the two? So, and to conclude then, I would say that this might sound all very pie in the sky and blah, 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 but I do think it's important to not lose track of a long-term political vision for no other reason than there's no other way to measure whether or not your short-term strategies are working. I mean, for instance, I was at one program when we were supposed to talk about what do you want to see in the long term with the anti-violence movement? And everybody said, I wanted better hotlines, I want more shelters, and not one person said, I wanted to see an end to violence against women. Like everybody had forgotten what the whole point of why we were doing the work. Now, if we kept that long-term vision in our heads, we could then come back to our strategies and say, hey, is the criminalization approach actually working? I don't think it is. You know, let's measure the two. If it's not taking us closer to where we want to go, maybe we need another short-term strategy. And by doing that, we always make sure our short-term strategies are taking us closer to our long-term vision. And finally, while you know we may not be able to envision kind of what a world that's not structured on oppression might be look like, given the fact that we've all been raised under this current society that's based on oppression, that doesn't mean that we can't be part of a collective vision and a collective movement that will go past our lifetimes in which we can contribute towards becoming closer to building the kind of world we actually want to live in. And so I will close with a quote from John Zingler from the 2003 World Social Forum, who said, quote, we know what we don't want, but the new world belongs to the liberated freedom of human beings. There is no way, you make the way as you walk. History doesn't fall from heaven. We make history. Thank you.
We're going to spend about a half hour at least for Q&A, and if you have questions, to start making your way to one of the two mics on the side, because we're recording this, which means it's going to be rebroadcast on the public access channel sometime in the very near future. So if you have questions, just step up to one of the mics and we'll kind of go back and forth from side to side.
So is there any comments or disagreements or ideas that people would like to share?
It seems that one of the primary challenges for any marginalized, oppressed populations is to get people who are in privileged positions to pick up the mantle of concerns for that. Mm-hmm. Without, and until that happens, you historically do not see any change, certainly not in this culture. Mm-hmm. So aside from praying mm-hmm. for your misfortunes to become deposited upon the privileged classes, how do you... Do you have any strategies for getting the concerns of marginalized people to be heard and felt and acted upon by privileged classes?
Well, again, the way I look at it, and this I should give an example here. When I was in Chicago, I had been involved in the nonviolent witness program around the spearfishing struggles in the late 1980s. And what was happening is that when the Chippewa were going spearfishing, they were getting surrounded by all these kind of white racist mobs saying things like "save a fish, spear a pregnant squaw." And when I first went there, this did not engender lots of positive feelings towards white people, especially when they're like shooting at you. But one of the persons who was involved in this, Walt Brissett, he provided a new framework that really changed my way of looking at the issues. And he said, you know, it would be a mistake to look at these mobs as your enemy, he said, because these are actually not your real problem, he told us. So the real problem is these multinational corporations like Exxon and Rio Algum who want to come here and they want to start mining. And when they do that, they're going to destroy the environment, not just for Native peoples, but for also these people who are harassing us. And so what we need to do is de-escalate the violence, but do it in such a way that we don't create such hostility with our neighbors that we can't go back to them later when we need to. And I thought he made no sense at all. I didn't get the whole nonviolence things. It seems silly. But it turned out I was completely and totally and utterly wrong. And one, I saw that what nonviolence meant. It wasn't like a passive strategy. It was a very powerful strategy because at one point, for instance, there was starting to get this escalation between some of the nonviolent witnesses and some of the mobs, and everybody's getting all uppity. And then one of the leaders said, okay, everybody, stop paying attention to them. We're going to just do a powwow. So somebody got the drum, people started dancing, and the white people got bored and left. So one, I saw that nonviolence can be a very powerful strategy. But two, as it turns out, Walt Brissett was exactly correct. It was not long afterwards that Exxon went in to make a bid to mine in that area. And the people who had been involved were able to go back to these same sports fishers and say, you know, you thought we were the enemy, but clearly we need to work together to deal with Exxon. And they were successful. They were so successful that they were able to pressure a pro-mining governor into supporting an anti-mining moratorium. So the point of that story is to say that made me rethink who I think my friends and enemies are. So what he was saying is keep the bigger picture in mind. Really, there's only a few people at the very top who have the major power in our society. Everybody else has privilege on a number of ways, but ultimately most of us are not benefiting from the current political and economic system, and our challenge is to get them to exchange their short-term interest in keeping those privileges in return for their long-term interest in transforming the political system. So that's how we have to think about base building. You start with your own community, you start to build that base, then you start to build allies for people who are next closest to you, and you keep going on and on until you can build a big enough base that can challenge that system. And that's what people are doing slowly by slowly, but again, what we see in Latin America is that it can be done. Any other thoughts?
Hi. I don't know if this is a question so much, but just a thought that I'd like you to respond to. But I'm thinking a lot about how violence happens against women. I think a lot of it has to do with a feeling of power over your own body and, ownership of your own fate. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of where that gets cut off of is in childbirth, mm-hmm. and that women will go there and feel like it's out of their hands and allow it to be out of their hands when it used to be something that was very much the business of women. And like my mother, for instance, she was a home birth, mm-hmm. and then I'm her seventh daughter,
right.
and she was gassed for all of us, wasn't mm-hmm. awake for any of our births. And it's like, mm-hmm. and this country, like 3/4 mm-hmm. of women end up having cesarean sections because it's all about intervention. So I wonder, like, if there's anything that if that makes sense to you, that's mm-hmm. part of the movement to have, like, it be more natural childbirth mm-hmm. and to take that back in our hands.
Yes, I think you're making an excellent point. I mean, the whole way gynecological obstetric services are done is almost its own form of sexual violence, where power is taken away from women's bodies and it's up to somebody else who gets to intervene. And I'm thinking of the work of Alice Skinnendorf, for instance, who's very active, and her mantra is, every woman is a midwife. This isn't some mysterious thing that we can't learn how to do. We all have the power to be able to do that. And I actually found this out myself when I inadvertently had to give birth to one of my nephews. But my sister said, I don't want to deal with these doctors. Come here. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. She goes, fine, I'll do it myself. So anyway, I had to go there. Had to go get, and then I had to go to the next door neighbor and say, can we have the Sunday paper? Like, why? I go, we're giving birth. We need... Well, fine, take the paper. Anyway, but it worked out perfectly fine. And that made me realize, hey, well, you know, what's happened to us that we feel like this is some weird knowledge that's about our own very own bodies, where we're learned not to trust ourselves, but trust somebody else over ourselves. So I think that's key. And a lot of people are doing it in Native communities, kind of reclaiming that knowledge and teaching ourselves. And that was also part of the feminist health centers, again, where women learned how to do their own pap smears, you know, do their own gynecological exams, and then... And seeing that this isn't knowledge that we can't do for ourselves too.
Welcome again, Andy. We appreciate you being here this evening. I was wondering how the dance class turned into building activism.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I do in the community, trying to build a base of consciousness mm-hmm. and empowerment, it's hard to get the conversation started.
Right.
And when you think of the issue of violence in mm-hmm. the community, mm-hmm. that is totally silent
mm-hmm.
Beyond the racism and the sexism, the mm-hmm. institutional racism that mm-hmm. a lot of my clients go through.
Mm-hmm.
The violence, the sexual violence mm-hmm. is totally silent.
Mm-hmm.
It's not talked about. So how does that conversation begin?
Mm-hmm.
Say, for instance, if you had a group of teenage girls mm-hmm. here at the Wealthy Street Theater
mm-hmm.
and they attended a dance class, how does that conversation begin where you are questioning them mm-hmm. about the silence that's in the community around mm-hmm. violence?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can just say for that particular model, what happened is they started doing dance classes, and at first they said they just did it for a long time before they did any organizing project. But part of the dance classes, they would kind of gradually put kind of political education in there, kind of talk about racism, sexism, etc. And then another thing they did is rather than just say, here's your issue, they decided to do their own street survey where they would ask girls, what's the big problem that you're facing? And they all said violence. Like, they didn't know that going in that was the major issue, but when they started just talking to people, that's the number one thing they said. So then, after a number of people have gone through the dance class, and they say, well, if you're interested in doing something about this problem, would you like to join our freedom school? So they have this freedom school set up where then they become kind of trained organizers. And then it just starts to grow from there, because then the organizers go talk to people on the street, etc. And then they also develop creative ways to get the education through. That's why we kind of developed this multimedia tour, because a lot of problem with our organizing is it tends to be very intellectually based, like the idea, if I tell you the right thing, you'll be convinced. But a lot of times we don't make our decisions based on just that. It's kind of how we feel about it emotionally. So there needs to be other ways to communicate ideas through the arts, through song, through music, etc. So one thing they did, for instance, was street theater, where one person would be harassing somebody else, and they would model ways you could intervene when you see harassment. And then they started doing this kind of we ended up doing this multimedia tour throughout the country. We had different kinds of artists, and looking at how, not just performing, but how do you use arts as an organizing strategy to reach people in kind of different ways. So those are just kind of the few things. It's kind of a slow process. It's not like it's a quick thing, but it ends up being able to open up a conversation. And then you'll also notice about these conversations where there's silence. It's a long time to break the silence, but once you do, it tends to mushroom quickly. You know what I'm saying? So it's kind of, through that work, I remember when I worked in violence, in Chicago, it was the same thing, you know. It was like, what we had to do is we would just go to the Indian Center every month and do high blood pressure testing. And we just had our sexual assault brochures. You know, it just seemed like you would be there for 8 months. And, you know, but then one day somebody reads it and tells three people, and then it grows from there and there, you know. But you have to kind of have patience with that kind of long-term commitment to building the issue. And I'll just give you one example. Another example, Minneapolis, I'm sorry, because there's many, they said they wanted to bring the issue of domestic violence, and this is before even domestic violence was an issue being talked about. Mm-hmm. So what they were kind of tricky. They said is that they got the matchbook things for the matches, and they put a little conference thing saying, and they went to the bowling alley, so they distributed all the bowling alleys, and they said there'll be a special meeting to address domestic violence, said, but registration is very limited, so call now. Only so-and-so, you know, 50 people allowed. So it made it look like it was this big to-do, and they were trying to just get 5 people to show up, but they ended up with like 100 people. So, you know, creativity is the key in persistence as well.
And one more question.
Sure.
Can you address the resistance? I find that this issue of violence in the community, it's like a service sector.
Mm-hmm.
If the mom or whoever has been violated, mm-hmm, brings up the fact that that's taken place, then an agency becomes involved. That person becomes the victim.
Mm-hmm.
Child Protection Services can, mm-hmm, be called in. Mm-hmm. All their living arrangement around this issue, mm-hmm, is putting that family in detriment. And so how does your consciousness raising deal with the institution of the people who are saying they're trying to help the, mm-hmm, situation of violence in the community?
Well, that's precisely why we decided we need to develop community accountability strategies that didn't rely on these institutions. And we felt there was always a problem, because like, we know there's a problem, and then we're telling them to go someplace that we know is going to make their life worse, and yet we don't feel like we have anything else to do. And then we got to a point which is, well, wait, why don't they have anything else to do? Why do we have to accept the terms as they've been set forth? Can we think outside the box and say maybe we want to do something else? So that's when people started to say, what is the response we would like? What are the other options that people could do besides calling the police or calling CPS? Now, this doesn't translate into us saying, well, if a survivor calls, we tell them, don't call the police. No, the issue isn't telling somebody, no, you can't do X. The issue is, why have we only given her X to do? Let's provide as many options as possible, and we might find that these other options might be a lot more helpful and effective in addressing violence in our communities.
And the institutions, do you see them coming around to like-mindedness?
Yeah, I'm not going to kind of advocate this kind of politics of purity where it's like this is the only right way to do kind of work. Mm-hmm. But what I think is important is, like, in other words, you need people on the inside, whatever that inside is. Mm-hmm. However, your work on the inside is going to work a lot better if you have one foot on the outside. In other words, so if we have kind of a base that's outside these institutions that grows and grows and is more powerful, then those on the inside will listen a lot more. They're not going to listen when they think you're not going anywhere. I mean, just to give a classic example of this was when I was working, you know, part of NCASA. Women of color had been putting up the issue of criminalization for like 20 years. Did we get anywhere? No. But when we started Insight and when we went someplace else, we got the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence to sign our statement in 3 months. You know, so developing that independent power base got the things to change on the inside much faster than had we just worked on the inside by itself.
Thank you.
Hello. Looking at the back of your book, it offers that you might expand our conception of violence to include the widespread appropriation of Indian cultural practices by whites, mm-hmm, and other non-natives.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you had, you know, touched on that, mm-hmm, or not. That was also in the advertisement for your talk tonight.
Oh, okay. I can touch on that. Yeah, I covered that in the book, but I was trying to make the talk a little bit shorter. But what I was trying to argue in this book, and you're probably familiar with everybody kind of is Indian in a former life, and everybody wants to do their own sweat lodge and this kind of thing. And so what I was trying to argue is that I think that kind of cultural appropriation is another form of sexual violence, and that it's, and ironically, I kind of look to the Bible for this, because if you look at the Hebrew words to know, That's the word used to connote sexual relationships, but also it's the same word to know somebody. So there's the idea about when you want to know about somebody, it's often an act of kind of intimacy, but it can also be an act of control or possession. And that's what I think has often happened in the history of Native genocide. It's not a mistake that this goes hand in hand with kind of anthropology's desire to know everything about Indian people. So part of kind of mastery and over a colonized people is to know everything about them, to study them, to understand them, because when you know them, you can control them. So I see that as kind of almost an act of sexual possession, an act of sexual violence. And then it's in addition to that, then it doesn't become a surprise that many of the people who are often engaged in spiritual appropriation use this for pornography. So I was looking at some of, for instance, there's this pornographic film called Native American Love Techniques, where it says, this man and woman, of course everybody was Cherokee, but anyway, the thing was, this man and woman will show the sacred circle in their sexual act, otherwise known as 69. So it's like totally kind of out of control. Then there was another book called Native American Love Secrets, etc. So we see how Native spirituality becomes kind of transformed into an act of pornography, and what by once again, Native peoples are not seen as peoples, but are seen as objects for consumerist interests for non-Native people. So that's just like a brief discussion of kind of the issue brought in that book.
Okay. And what would you say to someone who were perhaps practicing, mm-hmm. Non-Native, who was practicing, mm-hmm. attempting to practice spirituality, and their retort when questioned would be, well, who says it belongs mm-hmm. to the American Indians? You know, mm-hmm. what?
Right. I would say that whole analysis is, okay, first of all, there's two things. One is that I think people tend to look at Native spiritual traditions like Christianity. So they assume that because Christianity is a missionary religion, that they assume Native traditions are as well, and not look at that Native traditions are generally land-based and specific to a specific land-base, and hence there's not necessarily a desire to spread the word to everybody kind of on the planet. The second thing... Now, I just lost my thought. Oh, yeah, the second thing I would say also is that the spiritual appropriation is really a part of an ideology of genocide. That is, many times you look at this, in other words, what the logic of genocide says is that Native peoples must always be disappearing. And it's because we are disappearing that it's okay for other people to be here. And part of this act of disappearing then is that non-Native peoples become the inheritors of all that was indigenous. So that's why non-Native peoples get to do the Boy Scouts, that's why they should go do the ceremonies, because we're not around to do it. And when you think about it in the fundamental way, why would everybody else think that they should be doing Indian things if they really thought Indian people were still here to do it themselves? So really that whole desire is based on a logic of genocide. Anyway, so that's what I would say.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other ideas?
I just wanted to know what your feelings were regarding like intergenerational grief mm-hmm. and all the substance abuse that takes place in our communities. And how that plays into trying to empower people to even look at this vision and do something about it. And like you said with the boarding school issues, mm-hmm. how we have, and I think it's across the cultures too, is that there's a lack of parenting throughout mm-hmm. the United States.
Right.
And I just kind of wanted to know some of your thoughts about that.
Yeah, in the boarding school project, we're very, it's almost overwhelming. Like, the issue is so clearly there, but it's maybe more intense in this particular area, but I think it's true maybe about organizing in general, is that I think a lot of times when we think about organizing, we tend to have, to me, kind of this, it's almost a gendered distinction, kind of a private-public way of looking at organizing. That is, if you have a problem, take care of it at home. You know, or go get social services. But if you're organizing and you're rabble-rousing, you need to be strong, you need to be cool, and we don't want to hear about your problems. And of course, because you actually have problems, but you don't get to talk about it, it ends up screwing up the organizing work. And And instead, how can we have an organizing model that recognizes the trauma that we've dealt with and that we're still dealing with and all the effects of that trauma? How do we organize around trauma and not just see it as an ailment to be cured, but something that's part of the reality of our lives, but that we can still organize given the realities of our lives? And this became so totally apparent when we were doing the boarding school project, and this still happens if we have meetings. It's almost the rule rather than the exception, where people will travel 200 miles. They will drive to great expense and great difficulty because they really want to attend this meeting, and they get there and they can't get into the door because the flashbacks or the emotional trauma is just so intense. So then we're having to rethink how are we looking at this organizing so that we're organizing with the reality of the trauma that people are dealing with. And this is what we learned from Canada, because the folks there said when the disclosures of abuse first came up, people were filing these lawsuits, but there was nothing there to deal with the trauma. And as a result, they said that out of the first 29 men who disclosed abuse, 22 committed suicide. So that's why within our organizing, we've tried to make the healing central to the work at the same time. So it's not seeing people simply, again, as clients, but also as organizers, but at the same time, not having this idea that people aren't real people that have real trauma, that have real pain, that needs to be dressed openly in a supportive way. So I think what you're saying is kind of, in a certain way, the central question to be addressed if we're going to move forward. Because I think that will address, that will put forth for us a new vision about how to do organizing that will really match the reality of our communities. Well, thank you very much.
I encourage folks to visit the resource tables out in the lobby. Andrea's going to stick around for a bit, check out her book, and feel free to spend some time talking with the other organizations that are out here. And before we go, we are, my understanding is we're re-inviting drummers, singers back up here again for a traveling song. Thank you.